Coming up, in the Muslim world, the struggle between traditional Islam and modern ideas.
Now I can't travel anywhere through my internet connection. I can't go to the U.S. right now and see anything. So how come I'm still in this open communication with the whole world, I'm still embracing this?
And Sing Sing Prison, where some inmates can earn master's degrees in religious studies.
You got to say to yourself, I ain't doing this anymore. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I want to do something with my life.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Israel this week sent ground troops into Gaza and continued its air and artillery attacks. Thousands of civilians in Gaza have been killed or wounded, and a UN official said the violence and the shortage of food, fuel, water, medicine, and other necessities have created an absolutely disastrous humanitarian crisis. The International Red Cross and other relief agencies accused Israel of preventing ambulances and medical aid from reaching some of the severely wounded. Israel said it has been trying to avoid civilian casualties and assist the wounded. Protests against Israel broke out in Europe and the Middle East, and Pope Benedict XVI and many other religious and diplomatic leaders called for an immediate ceasefire, the Pope saying war and hatred are not the solutions to problems. Israel's critics charge that its tactics are unjust because the harm done, especially to civilians, is out of proportion to the likely gains. But Israel and its supporters blame Hamas, the militant anti-Israel group that controls Gaza, from which there have been 3,000 rocket attacks on Israeli territory in recent years.
This is a justified response because no nation on earth would permit her civilians to be indiscriminately targeted by terrorist rockets for 3 years and not respond.
The UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire, but both Israel and Hamas refused, and both continued their attacks. The conflict in Gaza dominated many of the observances held this past week in the Muslim world for Ashura, one of the holiest days on the Shiite Muslim calendar. Ashura marks the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. In Lebanon, the processions of mourning turned into marches of support for Palestinians in Gaza. In Karbala, Iraq, thousands of pilgrims traveled to the site of Imam Hussein's shrine. They joined mass processions and many performed self-flagellation to recall the Imam's sacrifice. Sectarian violence has marred the holiday in the past, and this year was no different. In Iraq, in the days before Ashura, dozens of Shiite pilgrims were targeted and killed by suicide bombers. One of the greatest underlying stories in the Muslim world is the struggle between the beliefs and practices of traditional Islam on the one hand, and on the other, the ideas of the modern Western world. How should someone be a devout traditional Muslim in a globalized high-tech environment? We have a special report from Kate Seeley in Cairo.
Here at Al-Azhar, one of the Muslim world's oldest and most respected centers of learning and worship, Muslims come to study and pray and ask how to live a devout life in the modern world. They come for fatwas, religious rulings that are non-binding. Clerics give advice on how to be good Muslims in matters of religion, family, and even finance. This vendor says fatwas are indispensable.
You feel very reassured after getting a fatwa, and you know you can build your future plans on it.
But recently, some of Azhar's fatwas have come under criticism. Last year, a cleric ruled that an unmarried man and woman could work together alone, which is normally forbidden in Islam. But only if the woman established a maternal relationship with her colleague by breastfeeding him 5 times. The cleric was suspended for his fatwa, which raised questions about Islam's relationship with modernity. In Egypt, the modern and the traditional live side by side. Like other developing countries, Egypt has been flooded in the last decade with new technologies like satellite TV and the internet. And that's exposed this conservative society to a confusing mix of Western values and culture. Islam Online is trying to help Muslims navigate this fast-changing environment. It's one of the Muslim world's most popular internet sites and provides religious advice as well as counseling and information about health, science, and culture in both Arabic and English. Clerics like Raghab Abu Mala take questions during live fatwa sessions 4 times a day. He says he receives more than 700 queries daily, but can only answer a fraction of them.
I think if we answered the 700 questions, then more would come. People are asking questions they never had before because of new technologies and influences.
Questions include whether it's permissible to find a spouse through the internet. Can a man divorce his wife in a text message? And what about internet chatting? Flirting between men and women is forbidden in Islam, but can they chat online? According to clerics here, it's best if a third party monitors the chat.
The Quran did not mention these details in their entirety, but it guides us in our advice.
But critics question the advice being given. Islam Online may be using modern technology, but it's spreading a very traditional message. The cleric who founded the site, Yusuf Qaradawi, is considered a moderate in the region, but his fatwas have opposed women traveling alone without a male guardian, and he's ruled against women being heads of state. For secular Muslims, like Dalia Ziyede, such views are decidedly anti-modern. Ziyede is a human rights activist. The 26-year-old accuses religious institutions in Egypt of spreading fundamentalist beliefs, like the veiling of women.
In my mother's age, when she was my age, I see her photos, it was tremendously different. It was, you know, she used to wear short skirts and she used to wear T-shirts and without sleeves, sleeveless T-shirts. And nobody used to ask her or to instruct her not to wear this or wear that.
Ziyede says in today's environment, she has to wear a headscarf in order not to be harassed. She blames this on what she calls the growing piety movement.
Everyone now believes that if only he gets religious, all his problems will be solved.
As part of her work, Ziad has been compiling fatwas that target women. Some clerics say they can't walk on the same side of the street as men. This fatwa from a high-profile Islamist claims they're not fit to be judges. Ziad says in this day and age, the principles of modernity should be universal. Principles like the acceptance of individual and women's rights, reason, doubt, and the separation of mosque and state. Instead, she says, Islamists are taking Egypt back to another era.
You know, now I can't travel anywhere through my internet connection. I can go to the U.S. right now and see anything there. So how come I'm still, in this open communication with the whole world, I'm still embracing these ideas? These fundamentalist ideas that goes back 1,400 years ago.
Egyptians have always been religious, but just a few decades ago, society was far more secular. Now, Islam is increasingly part of the public sphere. Quranic chants are played in taxis, restaurants, and shops. Signs encouraging women to wear the headscarf are plastered on walls. The niqab, the full face covering, virtually unseen in the past, is increasingly common. More and more men display prayer bumps on their foreheads. The piety trend, say analysts, is fueled by political frustration, poverty, and increasing Saudi influence. And it also has the support of much of Egypt's middle and professional classes. Ahmed Abu Haiba is a prominent media professional. He's launching the region's first Islamic music video channel to spread faith-based values. This video is about a farmer's dream of going to Mecca.
This is how the Muslim should be. He's a good man, he's have a good relationship with all the people around him. He loves kids, he loves simple people.
Abu Haiba named his station For Shabab, or For Youth in English. He says he's using the power of satellite TV to help rebuild a Muslim youth identity.
We don't have clear, stable, strong identity. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help the young people to establish their identity. This is the same identity that Prophet Muhammad presented to his companions.
Abu Haiba hopes his videos will help counter some of what he says are the negative influences of Western music videos and television.
And this drove us now to the drugs and to relationships, which is really doesn't fit with our culture.
In contrast, his videos emphasize community and family values like respect for elders. Women mainly play the role of wives and mothers in the background. Abu Haiba says he doesn't choose to embrace the principles of modernity because they're not in keeping with Islamic values.
I don't think that modernity is part of these values. I mean, when I learn Islam, I know there's a part of it cares about people's life and people's life changes. But still, always the major values and the major pillars, as it is, it never changes with time. Modernity is something linked with time, and Islam is timeless.
That view of Islam is the problem today, says Gamal al-Benna, a reformist cleric. He says Islamists have a fixed reading of the Quran because long ago scholars banned new interpretations of the religious texts.
The religious institutions tell us that innovation will lead us down the wrong path. Anything that has to do with innovation is dangerous, and that's wrong. You can't say that religious opinions made over 1,000 years ago are valid for all times. We must have a revolution in the understanding of Islam, a revolution almost like Martin Luther's.
Until then, says Benna, Islam will not be able to accommodate itself to the modern world. The 88-year-old has written dozens of books about the need for the renewal of Islam. He's even issued a fatwa saying Muslim women don't have to cover their hair. Benna says Muslims must stop relying on scholars to interpret the holy texts. Instead, he says they should read the Quran directly, keeping in mind its emphasis on knowledge and wisdom.
The Quranic verse goes, "It was revealed to them, the Quran and wisdom." The search for wisdom has proven itself to be a successful experiment for all peoples and all times. We have to adapt and we have to learn from all other experiences with wisdom, so that Islam isn't a closed box, but it has an open window to the world.
Benna believes such reform will take place, but long after his lifetime. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Kate Seeley in Cairo.
In other news, the Reverend Richard John Newhouse has died of complications from cancer. The 72-year-old Roman Catholic priest was founder and editor of the conservative journal First Things, and was a leading intellectual of the Christian right. Newhouse was a Lutheran pastor and liberal civil rights advocate before the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision changed his political and theological outlook. He converted to Catholicism in 1990 and was ordained a priest the next year. In Detroit, a new archbishop for the Catholic Archdiocese, Alan Vigneron, will replace Cardinal Adam Maeda, who's retiring at age 78. Vigneron is a Michigan native and had most recently been the Bishop of Oakland, California. He'll begin leading the 1.4 million-member Detroit Archdiocese at the end of the month. We have a Lucky Severson story today on an effort to help those in prison with the beliefs and attitudes and skills they'll need when they get out. Recently, Lucky discovered a well-established advanced degree program offered by the New York Theological Seminary for some of the prisoners at Sing Sing, up the river from New York.
This is a notoriously tough maximum security Sing Sing prison in New York State. About 1,800 prisoners are incarcerated here, most for very serious crimes.
The stone building down there?
Yeah.
That's the cell block, the original cell block from 1825.
1825.
Mm-hmm. It is a forbidding place, not where you would expect to find a program offering an accredited master's degree in professional studies in religion.
We're always trying to remain in our comfort zone.
The course is sponsored by the New York Theological Seminary. It's been at Sing Sing for a quarter of a century. So has the instructor, Edward Hunt.
Caring is everybody's business.
He's not easy.
Let me explain something to you. They're going to earn this degree. And when they stand before people, they will be able to defend themselves as master's degree students. No, they're going to earn it. These men work like government mules.
The course, which is non-denominational, gets funding from churches, foundations, and individuals. In 26 years, about 350 student inmates have graduated. Those attending this year's class are serving an average of 15 years to life. Robert Woolley has been on the inside 21 years for kidnapping.
I beat up a guy named William Eberly and basically drove him around while I cleaned out his bank accounts in an effort to sustain a drug habit that was unsustainable, you know. And it's a shame that I'll have to live with for the rest of my life because this man deserved none of what I did to him. And I can only hope that someday I can, you know, face him and apologize to him.
I've noticed I have all these little doors that I put a lot of my emotional stuff in.
The men we spoke with all seemed relieved to talk about their crimes and to say they deserve to be punished. Only 16 students are accepted each year after they have earned bachelor's degrees, usually through correspondence courses from accredited colleges. They have lots of time to study and think.
I don't care what we're going through, what battles we're fighting, we always have the option to do the right thing. It's a matter of deciding I want to change, and once you make that decision to want to change, to go about it full-fledged.
You got to say to yourself, I ain't doing this anymore. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I want to do something with my life.
I just received my bachelor's degree this June from Mercy College.
Charles Garner is in 20 years to life for murder.
13 years ago, I took a young man's life by the name of Vernon Chapman. We got into an argument, and the end result was I shot a rifle into a house, and Vernon Chapman lost his life.
Garner had dropped out of high school, but in prison he earned his GED and then his bachelor's degree, and now he's working on his master's.
I know I was going to come to prison for a long time. I mean, there was no getting around that. I made up my mind not to leave prison the same young man that I entered prison.
But I'm saying, did we do our 2 hours of library time?
If these men share a role model, it is Julio Medina. Before he became a visiting instructor, Julio was one of them. He spent time for dealing drugs and then worked his way into the New York Theological Seminary program.
The seminary, New York Theological Seminary master's degree program, for me when I was in that classroom, was the one of the single most important turning points in my life.
When he got out and met the real world, Julio ran head-on into the same kind of obstacles confronting most of the 600,000 ex-cons who re-enter American society each year.
I mean, transition is one of the scariest things I think I've ever encountered in my life. To come home, to start again, a new life, a life that you don't know. It's kind of this rebirth. You're coming home and saying, now, what is employment like? Because I never worked before in my life. You know, how do I supposed to act on a job? How do I act with my family?
If you notice, on your Exodus contract, you'll see goal.
So he founded the Exodus Transitional Program in East Harlem, his old neighborhood, upstairs from the Church of the Living Hope. Ex-cons come to Exodus for counseling from other ex-cons on how to learn to look for a job and keep it. Drug counseling, how to get identification. Nationwide, about 60% of inmates who get out are back inside within 3 years. Of those who go through Exodus, only 1 in 3 go back.
And that's what it's all about, being around for a long time to come. I want to be able to be one of those old dads, you know, one of those old dads.
Hideo says Exodus works because he and the other counselors are ex-cons, so they understand what their clients are up against.
I demand the best possible work because not only the degree, but it's in preparation when these guys come back to the community. They're leaders. They're being prepared to be leaders in their community.
The chances of an inmate getting into a program like this one are slim to none. The majority of U.S. prisons offer few rehabilitation programs, although they are growing slowly in popularity. The superintendent at Sing Sing, Lewis Marshall, says there aren't nearly enough rehab programs in the prison systems.
If possible, we should do more. We should do more. Housing people is probably one of the saddest things. People are going to think. They're not going to stop thinking because they're in prison. The question is, what do you introduce in their lives while they're incarcerated? It's not the only individual that you're helping. You're helping him plus others who are observing his conduct, behavior, and change.
Superintendent Marshall says it costs between $35,000 and $40,000 a year to house an inmate at Sing Sing, and taxpayers keep paying when they keep coming back.
So therefore, if you're going to invest, because you are investing whether you believe it or not, you're investing in them staying or you're investing in them preparing to go back out, which way you want to put your money.
We need to learn how to function on the outside for our own selves personally.
The recidivism rate among the master's program's graduates is about 8%, far below the national average. At least 6 grads have gone on to become ordained clergymen, and a majority go into some kind of church-related work.
It's good. I'm dealing with it because it's allowing me to fill the rooms up with joy.
Victor Harris is serving 25 years to life for second-degree murder. He says he's learned it is possible to change.
I think college in general can change people's thinking so they can change the way they respond and act to things. But I've transformed, I think, a lot differently.
It's one thing to get inmates to actually change. It's another to get others to believe they have.
For a guy as bad a drug abuser as I was, you know, many people don't believe it. That's a fact. My own brother doesn't believe it, you know. So, and it's a real pain in my heart that he stuck with me for all the years when I wasn't doing the right thing. And then, like, when I finally do make a change, it's like I cried wolf.
It's through those same wounds that we're able to reach out and heal others.
Julio's drumbeat theme to his captive students is that they owe a debt to society, and serving a sentence does not pay it.
My main goal is to go back and give back to my community, and I want to open up a community center in the name of the person, Vernon Chapman, in the name of Vernon Chapman, the young man's life that I took, in the community in which I took his life.
We are obligated. We owe something. You know, I don't care what you say or whatever it is. We owe something to this community. We just can't go back and say, okay, we did our time. Everything is fine.
Julio was honored by President Bush and his wife, Laura, for his role with the Exodus program. He's now working on his doctor's degree. But he's worried that the dismal economy will mean even less funding for programs like his and the New York Theological Seminary. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson at Sing Sing.
Finally, as Washington prepares for the inauguration of President-elect Barack Obama, the Library of Congress wants to preserve the moment with the help of houses of worship. The library is asking churches, mosques, synagogues, and others to send in texts and audio and video recordings of sermons and speeches about the swearing-in of the nation's first African-American president. So, your spiritual leader's inauguration sermon could be saved forever in the 2009 Sermons and Orations Project. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more analysis and commentary on the Gaza war. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from a Buddhist ceremony in India this past week, where hundreds of monks and devotees gathered to pray for world peace. The prayers were led by the Karmapa Lama, Tibetan Buddhism's second highest ranking spiritual leader, after the Dalai Lama.